This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Scientists in our region are trying to keep track of the invasive pests that have made their way into Vermont. These bugs and diseases can wreak havoc on the ecosystem. We are joined today by Savannah Ferreira. She's a forest health specialist, and she works with the Vermont Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. She runs a forest biology lab in Randolph. Savannah, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We're so glad to have you. Tell us a little bit about what a forest health specialist is. What do you do?
Yeah, so I work with the forest health team with the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. And basically, I help the public or foresters or other environmental enthusiasts or professionals diagnose tree diseases, why their tree might be declining, insects, mushrooms, as well as work with a larger forest health team to track the spread of insects and diseases, both that are from Vermont and then things that were introduced, some of our invasive pests.
Well, let's talk about some of those invasive pests. And first, tell us why we're saying pests instead of just insects.
Yeah, so a pest is a term that we use to describe insects, diseases, plants, both terrestrial and aquatic, that are introduced and causing a problem in our local ecosystems. So if we just said insects, we would be ignoring all of the other organisms.
All right, let's kick things off with the emerald ash borer. What is it?
Yeah, so an emerald ash borer is an invasive wood-boring insect that affects all species of ash trees in Vermont. It causes our ash trees to decline and eventually die. They create these S-shaped galleries in the bark. You might not see them if the bark is still present, but you'll be able to see woodpecker flecking because the birds are trying to find the larva. You might see severe dieback, and you might see D-shaped exit holes coming out of the tree.
D-shaped exit holes? Like the letter D?
Yep, the letter D.
Huh. All right. And when were these first found in Vermont?
This was first found in Plainfield in 2018.
All right. And tell us again, what kind of plants do they target?
All species of ash tree. So we have black ash, green ash, and white ash in Vermont.
Okay. And how bad is the emerald ash borer? What's its effect?
Yeah, so emerald ash borer is able to kill trees. We typically don't start seeing symptoms of decline from emerald ash borer until 3 to 5 years of the insect being in the tree. And once it starts showing these symptoms, it tends to die a lot faster. They do travel by themselves about 4 miles a year by flight, but humans are actually responsible for the large spread that they have, not only in Vermont, but in most of the United States. Mm. So we try to not move firewood or other wood products that might be infested, because it can cause entire stand mortality where we have a lot of ash overstories.
Mm. Wait, say more about that. So the way to not spread them is to not move firewood?
Yeah, we always encourage to buy firewood where you're going to burn it. Pests and diseases don't know state lines. They don't know county lines. So when we bring plant material or firewood, maybe across state lines, from a state, say Massachusetts, into Vermont, we have the potential to spread invasive pests or pathogens that are present in Massachusetts into Vermont.
Mm, okay. So is that, I'm curious here because I want to know how the state, how folks like you track the movement of these types of insects and pests. How can you tell that it came into the state, like through firewood, for example?
Yeah, so for a lot of our invasives, we rely heavily on public reporting through vtinvasives.org. When people are recreating outside, maybe they're camping or hiking, and they see any signs or symptoms of our invasive pests, they can send in a report. And then subject area experts, including myself and others with FPR and the Agency of Agriculture, will review those and follow up. Sometimes we're able to follow up at a campground, so we know that maybe this is where it came in through a recreationalist or a camper. Sometimes pests just show up in somebody's backyard and they have not traveled out of state in some time. And we have other evidence that might support that it came in through other natural factors.
Mm, okay. All right. So that's the emerald ash borer. Anything else that we should know about it, or tips for spotting it?
Yeah, I would look for our woodpecker activity. So sometimes it's known as blonding, D-shaped exit holes, serpentine or S-shaped galleries, and then a lot of apocormic sprouting or stress sprouts.
What does that mean?
Apocormic sprouting is kind of a last ditch effort of a tree. So as it's starting to decline, it takes all the resources it has left and it just puts out these branches. And the branches aren't maybe at the top of the tree where normally foliage is, but they're coming out of the bark sporadically. They might be coming out of the base of the tree sporadically. And it's a sign of decline.
Okay. All right. Well, the emerald ash borer making its way around Vermont. Next up, and I got to say, I think this is my favorite name of a critter that we are discussing today, the elm zigzag sawfly. Where did it get this name from?
Yeah, so the elm zigzag sawfly makes this really characteristic zigzag pattern of defoliation in elm trees. So if you look at an elm leaf, in between the leaf veins, there'll be a back and forth zigzag when they're starting to first defoliate the trees. Elm zigzag sawflies are actually able to have multiple generations per year. So over time, they will end up eating the entire leaf. So you're only going to be able to see that classic zigzag pattern in the early stages of defoliation.
Okay. What exactly do they look like?
Yeah, so they are probably about the size of a bee, but they differ in color. I would encourage listeners to look for this zigzag shape more so than looking for the insect themselves, because they are very tiny and hard to identify.
Oh, okay. How tiny are we talking?
About 1.8 millimeters long as a larvae. And then their adult size could be about 7 to 8 millimeters.
Okay. All right. So these zigzag sawflies are attacking elm trees in the state. Where did they come from?
Yeah. So it was first detected in Canada in 2021. And so far in Vermont, we've just seen reports of defoliation in our northwestern parts of the state. However, it has since spread to many other states along the eastern seaboard. So we're going to increase our monitoring efforts this season throughout the rest of the state to see if we can get a better handle on its true distribution.
And once you find out that it's in a certain part of the state, like what do you do next? Is there any stopping it?
Right now, most of the efforts are going through research. We're working closely with the Forest Service to set up phenology monitoring. So we're trapping for this insect and trying to determine how many generations per year it has in Vermont. And then that will help inform management decisions later down the road.
Okay. And the elm zigzag sawfly, I heard that it reproduces very quickly, which is one of the struggles of trying to control the population. Is that right?
That's right. They have multiple generations per year.
So one species that has been top of mind for many folks in the past few years is the spongy moth. Tell us a little bit about this insect.
Yeah, so spongy moth is an invasive hardwood defoliator. So it primarily defoliates the leaves of our oak species, but during outbreak periods, we can see widespread defoliation to other host species, as well as sometimes conifers as well.
And what do they look like?
So as caterpillars, they're hairy. They can be about maybe 1 to 2 inches long. They also have these dots on their back. It's about, I think it's 4 to 6 blue dots on the top, and then it goes somewhere between 6 and 8 red dots on the lower part of their back.
Okay. And what's the cause for concern with the spongy moth? And we hear about these caterpillars. I think a couple of years ago there was a big outbreak. Are they here every year? Are some years worse than others? What's going on?
Yeah, so we've had spongy moth in Vermont for many decades. It's been about 2 decades since we've had an outbreak. And that's primarily because we have a biocontrol agent that's present in our Vermont woods called Entomophaga myomyga. And this is a soil-borne entomopathogenetic fungi. So it's
what does that mean?
Yep, I'm going to break that down.
Okay.
It's a fungus that's in the soil, and it's specific to spongy moth. And when we have really wet conditions, like we did last year in the spring, this fungus is able to proliferate and then infect the caterpillars. And they basically eat the caterpillars from the inside out and really help to knock down those populations. So when we have summers where we have these successive years of droughts, that fungus is just not able to become well established. So the spongy moth caterpillars are able to reach outbreak levels.
It eats the caterpillars from inside out?
Yes, it's really gross and cool to watch.
I'm guessing you've watched it.
Yeah, so you can actually see if you have this biocontrol on your landscape, because you'll see the spongy moth crawling up the tree, and they will hang vertically and get really skinny because it's getting eaten from the inside. And then the fungus will actually fruit out and throw the spores onto other caterpillars that are coming up the tree, for spongy moth caterpillars specifically, as well as hibernate in the soil for the successive years coming.
Wow. Okay. That sounds like a horror movie in the making.
Yeah, but it's great for our Vermont forests, and it's a big reason on why this current outbreak is ending.
That's fascinating. All right, Zed, you've been kind of tracking this over the last few years, or your colleagues have?
Yeah, so the forest health team has these long-term monitoring plots where we count how many spongy moth egg masses are in our plots every year, as a predictor of whether or not we're anticipating to see an outbreak. In addition, we also do aerial surveying to map areas of defoliation.
Hmm. Let's go to John in Waterford. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. You mentioned that woodpecker activity can be an indicator of the presence of some of these pests. Could there be a possible benefit then to the pest activity because woodpeckers have such a readily available food source?
Hmm. Thanks, John. Savannah, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. For the woodpeckers, it could be good to get an additional larvae to consume. Our woodpeckers also eat a lot of other native borers, so their diets aren't entirely comprised of emerald ash borer for this pest specifically.
So there's some other kinds of borers that they're chomping on.
Yeah, there's a lot of what we call native borers, so borers that our ash trees were able to evolve with over time, that although they're present in the tree, they're not the causal agent of decline or mortality, where emerald ash borer gets to these higher populations and then are able to kill the tree.
Mm. And let's add one more voice to the conversation here. Emily Inouye is the Vermont Agency of Agriculture's plant health team lead. It's her job to safeguard Vermont's agriculture and forestry from plant pests that could wreak havoc on our natural environment. Emily, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So tell us a little bit more about what you do to support Vermont's forests from these plant pests. What exactly does your job entail?
Sure. Before I do that, I just want to just be clear. A lot of the forestry stuff, it's a big intersection with the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. So hi, Savannah. Savannah and I work very closely together. So from the invasive pest, from the forestry perspective, what we in ag focus on are primarily federal pests of concern. The Federal Animal Plant Health Inspection Service gives us some funding to go out and prioritize the pests that aren't known to occur in Vermont yet. So we go out and try to detect them early, and then we bring in our partners like Forest, Parks, and Recreation to help tackle the problem and get as many perspectives at the table as possible to come up with a solution that works.
Mm, okay. So let's talk about some of those pests that you're keeping an eye on that haven't made it into Vermont yet, but you're very wary of. What's top of your maybe most wanted list, we'll call it?
Let's see. Probably the one that we are always worried about recently is the spotted lanternfly. And I was laughing because you were talking about whimsical names and nightmares. Spotted lanternfly checks both of those boxes. It is quite a whimsical name, and it creates a rather nightmare of a situation in established large populations. So there you go. They can be both.
What kind of nightmare of a situation can these create?
Well, What they do is they cluster together and they feed in giant groups. And what happens is they're sucking up the sap from the tree that they're feeding off of, and then they poop out the stuff called honeydew, which is basically sugar water, and it's really sticky. It's disgusting. It attracts stinging insects and other insects, and it also provides a great base for sooty mold and other things. So in urban areas, people's cars have been covered, people's decks have been covered. It's not a great situation when you see a large group of them, and you can see it if you go online and look up, you know, clusters of spotted lanternfly. It really is like a moving trunk of a tree. It's oof. Disgusting.
and they're not in Vermont yet?
There is no established population that we know of in Vermont. And I have to choose my words carefully because we don't know what we don't know. And I don't want to come across as the state has a pulse on every single invasive pest that's coming. It's just impossible. So what we lean on is the public sending in reports, sending in photos, surveys that are happening. But that doesn't mean that just because we don't know that it's not here doesn't mean that it's not. Mm. So as far as we know, spotted lanternfly, and we abbreviate to SLF, is not known to occur in a reproducing population. However, we do find active interceptions of live insects from time to time, and we get calls and reports about it, and we follow up on that.
Mm. Calling it the SLF does make it sound a little bit more formidable than spotted lanternfly.
Yeah.
Savannah Ferreira with Vermont Forest Parks and Rec. Have you also studied the spotted lanternfly? Any details to add that we should know about it?
I don't have any details to add. So Forest Parks and Recreation works really close with Emily's team at the Agency of Agriculture. We assist their team, but they take the lead on spotted lanternfly.
Okay, great. I love this divide and conquer on these pests out there. Let's go back to the phones. We have Michael in Windsor on the line. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Great, thanks. Hi, Savannah. I attended your presentation at the Tree Warden Conference on May 23rd at VTC, and you mentioned about using predators and parasites to control the hemlock woolly adelgid. And you said that it works very well, and that the limiting factor was you couldn't get enough of them because of the rearing facilities couldn't produce enough. So my question is, could those predators and parasites be reared around here, for example, in the closed Windsor Prison facility? There's been a lot of discussion about what to do with those state-owned buildings, and some of us think it could be used to produce those predators and parasites of the HWA that you said are kind of in limited supply. Hmm. What do you think?
Michael, thanks for your question. Savannah, thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Right now, we're working closely with other New England and Eastern states, so that includes Northern Mid-Atlantic region as well, who are actually working on setting up their field insectaries for hemlock woolly adelgid specifically. So we might not have to do things like that in-house in Vermont because our neighbors working close by are doing it. So we try to work collaboratively with neighboring states, so we're not duplicating efforts, and we can help the most with the most pests.
Hmm. Well, thanks, Michael, for your call. Let's go next to Rick and Adamant. Rick, you're on the line.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, my big concern right now is plant species that are really running rampant, like the one that's most notable right now, I think, is the chervil with the white flower, and it really spreads along roadways. Along there's stretches of the interstate are just, you know, solid white with it, and it's very persistent and nasty. Of course, the other things that I've been battling is buckthorn, honeysuckle, and then there's this Asian yellow iris that gets in waterways and wetlands, and I don't know if you've got solutions for all those things. Of course, one more little thing is that the insect that I'm really concerned about, and I think we've kept it out of Vermont. As far as I know, it's been kind of confined to Worcester, Mass, and that's the Asian longhorn beetle.
Mm. Yeah, well, thank you so much for that call. It sounds like battling a lot of pests over there. Let's start with Emily. I'm not sure if you caught all the things that Rick mentioned there. Are any of those on your kind of watch out for list? Or do you have any suggestions
for him?
I sure did,
and the caller hit the jackpot. I think I can answer all of those questions. The Agency of Agriculture, our team, oversees the noxious weed rule. And that is something, you know, I just want to validate the caller that he's not alone. A lot of people, including myself, notice a lot of these plants out in the environment and are concerned about it. And it kind of feels like an impossible situation when you just kind of consider the scale of it. What we do is we try to regulate the movement. There's not much we can do on except, you know, educate the public and also from a regulation standpoint, tell people that they are not allowed to move certain species of plants. And so we have something called the noxious weed quarantine, and that lists all the plants currently that are illegal to transport around Vermont. And that's kind of what we can do. And I realize that is an insufficient answer for people that want us to come out and eradicate it. I wish we could. But there is a scale of, you know, pragmatism. And unfortunately, a lot of these plants at this point aren't eradicable just because of how widely spread they are. But there are ones that we are concerned about and want people to keep an eye out, because if we were able to detect them early, we believe we could do something about it and, you know, do some good.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any tips for someone like Rick who's trying to figure out how to keep some of these out of maybe their gardens or their land?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, educate yourself. And I don't have a uniform, this is what you should, just because every single plant species is going to have a different management approach. I would say on private property, if it's, you know, if you identify it correctly, look it up or reach out to somebody who, you know, can apply pesticides, who's certified, and, you know, just go through, not necessarily use it, but go through all your options. A lot of times, like Japanese knotweed, that's a big one that people are constantly, you know, complaining about for good reason. There's people have gone through trying to dry out the stems. They go through and smother the roots with trash bags. Some of them just take a lot of time and dedication, but some of them are possible to, you know, make some gains without using chemical treatment, which is what a lot of people prefer. So I would say it's primarily education, learning how to identify it, and then taking the, you know, the approach that makes the most sense to you, whatever that may be.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. We got some questions via email as well. One from Jonathan in Shrewsbury, who asks, what means of control, either biological, chemical, or other, are being developed for some of the primary forest pests, specifically insects they're asking about, and how successful are they? Savannah, can you speak to this, some of these means of control?
Yeah, so it really depends on what we're talking about. If we start with emerald ash borer, for example, the state has been releasing three different species of biological control agents. So these are small, stingless, parasitoid wasps. They're about the size of a black fly, so you wouldn't even know that they're wasps, and they absolutely cannot sting humans or pets. But they basically seek out and find emerald ash borer larvae in the wood while they're still in the tree. They lay their eggs inside either the eggs or the larvae themselves, depending on the species, and then consume the insect from the inside. With that type of release, we're not really trying to eradicate emerald ash borer from our landscape, because it's considered impossible at this point in level of infestation. But we're hoping to knock down levels to try to make emerald ash borer less of an invasive pest and have it be treated more like a native pest in our region. Hmm. We also have, for hemlock woolly adelgid, we've been releasing biocontrol agents, like our last caller mentioned. This is a predatory beetle that we release that seek out and eat the the hemlock woolly adelgid adults on the needles of the tree. We also recently published a hemlock conservation management guide for Vermont, and that can be found on our FPR website. And this will go through the whole toolbox of different things that we can use to manage hemlock woolly adelgid. There's a whole suite of insecticides, horticultural oils, and different types of biological control agents that we can use. So it really varies depending on the pest. And if you have specifics on exactly what pest you want more information about, you can feel free to reach out and I can send those your way.
Great. And we will have the information and links to professional bios for both of our guests on vermontpublic.org and in the show notes for today's show in our podcast feed. Emily, can you tell us a little bit more about how pests like the ones we're discussing today are regulated on a federal level and how that's different from the state level in which you work?
Sure. And it is kind of nuanced. And I don't understand all the ways the APHIS, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, makes some of their decisions. So I can't speak too much about how they make their decisions. But a federal pest means generally that they are going to receive federal support. So there is funding attached to it from the feds, and it is often connected to a larger national system of survey. So a lot of times these pests are detected. Emerald ash borer, for example, used to be a federal pest when it was first detected in Vermont in 2018. And then over time, as it rapidly spread throughout the continental United States, at some point there is an algorithm, I'm assuming, that the federal government decides this is literally a lost cause at the federal level, so we have to give it over to each state. Unfortunately, when that happens, the federal money stops as well. So it's up to the states then to approach the management and, trying to deal with the pest on their own. So good and bad. We definitely don't want the pests that are on the federal list. And with that comes money to often deal with it.
Interesting. Okay. Savannah, I'm curious too how your office, your work has to deal with that split between what's regulated at a federal level, regulated at a state level, maybe what local communities, towns and cities in Vermont are trying to address themselves. How does all that work?
Yeah, so we work very similar to the Agency of Agriculture. Even though Emerald ash borer, for example, is something that used to be federally regulated and then became deregulated, it being regulated and trying to slow the spread has helped slow the spread and introduction into Vermont. So I know sometimes it feels like when we're talking about invasive pests that it feels like a lost cause or it feels like a war we're not going to win. There's measures that we can take on the local, state, federal levels that really do make a difference. So by still implementing slow the spread recommendations in Vermont, encouraging folks to not move firewood, and report sightings as they see it, as well as get educated themselves on all of these pests, we can really make a difference at all of these levels.
Well, we got an email from a listener named Paul who writes, "We've been living here in Vermont for 40 years. Over the last five or so, we have suddenly been attacked by carpenter bees. Would you tell us about these bees, where they come from, why now, and what to do about them?" Savannah, are carpenter bees considered pests or considered invasive?
So they're not considered invasive. They are kind of a genus that includes several hundreds of different types of bees. So I can't be too specific with you right now without seeing a photo. But if they want to send in a photo or the damage that they're seeing, carpenter bees are just a common name for many different species. But I'd love to take a look and provide you with more detail.
All right, Paul, we'll send us a photo. We can get that to Savannah for you. Let's take one more call before we have to take a short break. Ryan in White River Junction is on the line. Ryan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What's your question or comment?
So my question is, you had a caller calling in about invasive plants, right? So
yes.
He was speaking of wild chervil. So is that currently on the noxious weed list?
I actually don't think wild chervil is. I apologize. I don't have that list up right now. It is a pretty specific list. It's broken into class right. A and class B list. Class A's are the ones that aren't known to occur in Vermont yet, although one that's still on there was detected in Burlington last year, which is the pale swallowwort. But the class B's are the ones like knotweed, and generally those are not considered early detection rapid response species because they are so widespread. And there are also plenty of species like wild chervil that aren't listed on the list because there is a long process to get them on the list. We're trying to change that. But yeah, there are definitely, I just want to own that there are plants that we are concerned about that aren't on that list. And we are aware of it and we're trying to fix that.
Ryan, did you have another question?
I mean, essentially the state is spreading this on, you know, unwillingly by roadside mowing. I mean, that's how that plant is getting, you know, put on every roadside in the state of Vermont, because a little patch of it shows up, they go through, they hit it with a roadside mower, and they spread it down to the next road, you know, and then the next year it goes onto the following road. So, I mean, at this point, that's all they're mowing is wild chervil, knotweed, and, you know, other invasive plants. So essentially, they're responsible for spreading it.
Mm. Ryan, thanks for your call. Emily, I'm curious if you have thoughts about his concern there, the role of roadside mowing in the state.
I think the caller is correct, and it's also an impossible situation for the Agency of Transportation. So, yes, I think it is literally at this point, because of how widespread it is, it's almost impossible if we're going to be, you know, if the Agency of Transportation is going to be mowing, they're going to be cutting that stuff. And there is no easy answer to this, and I wish there was, but yeah, all of us are aware that that is a problem.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, thank you for your call. And to both of our guests, thank you for the work that you are both doing to try to keep some of these invasive pests from reaching that point here in Vermont. Savannah Ferreira is with the Vermont Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. Savannah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And Emily Inouye is with the Agency of Agriculture. Thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise with us.
Thanks very much.